Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 28, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Keystone XL pipeline in the Nebraska Supreme Court. My name is Christian Corgan and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. So today I'm going to go ahead and turn the call over to our moderator, Tyler Ward, who is a member of the Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group's Executive Committee for the Federal Society. So, Tyler, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you and to tell us more about the topic and today's speaker. So the floor is yours, Tyler.
Thank you, Christian. On January the 9th of this year, the Nebraska Supreme Court held that the law dictating the potential path of the Keystone XL pipeline through the state was not unconstitutional. President Obama previously cited this pending lawsuit as a reason to delay making an approval decision on the controversial pipeline projects. Today, we're fortunate to have Nebraska's former Deputy Attorney General, Katie Spahn, who argued the case. And Katie Spahn currently is a partner at Bruning Law Group, a founding partner. And prior to co-founding Bruning Law Group, Ms. Spahn served as Nebraska Attorney in the Nebraska Attorney General's office for 12 years, with the last 2 years as Deputy Attorney General. In that role, she was tasked with handling the state's most complex civil litigation cases, specializing in nationally significant issues of constitutional law. Ms. Spahn was an integral part of numerous multi-state challenges to federal regulation and played a critical role in the state's challenge to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. In September of 2014, Ms. Spahn led the victory in defending the constitutionality of a law regulating the Keystone XL pipeline before the Nebraska Supreme Court. So we're very happy today to have Katie Spahn with us, who will tell us a little bit about the case that was recently decided by the Nebraska Supreme Court. Katie?
Thank you, Tyler. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Katie Spahn. I want to, first of all, thank the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum today. And let's get right into the discussion on the Keystone Pipeline litigation in Nebraska. Again, my name is Katie Spahn, and I served at the Nebraska AG's office for the last 12 years, where I was lead counsel for the state and argued before the Nebraska Supreme Court in defense of the constitutionality of our pipeline siting laws. But before we get into the litigation, let's set the stage for the legal showdown. Prior to the fall of 2011, Nebraska law did not provide for review of the environmental impact of pipeline routes in Nebraska. All a pipeline had to do was acquire a right-of-way over a landowner's property, sometimes utilizing eminent domain. Now, that landowner could challenge during the eminent domain proceeding whether the pipeline served a public purpose, but as a practical matter, no landowner had ever successfully brought such an action. After much outcry concerning the Keystone XL pipeline's threat to Nebraska's groundwater, the governor, in the fall of 2011, called a special session of the Nebraska legislature. The result was the Major Oil Pipeline Siting Act, which vested the Nebraska Public Service Commission with primary review of the siting of pipelines of a particular size in Nebraska. For the first time under MOPSA, major oil pipelines were required to obtain approval prior to having eminent domain authority. In the spring of 2012, the Nebraska legislature amended MOPSA to allow an alternative option for pipeline siting, and that would be through approval by the governor following a self-funded environmental review by the pipeline company with the state's Nebraska Department of Environmental Quality. Three plaintiffs, Randy Thompson, Susan Luby, and Susan Donovan, brought suit challenging the constitutionality of the amendment of MOPSA in Lancaster County District Court. Lancaster County is the county seat for Lincoln, for those of you not familiar. The plaintiffs, who owned land on or near the pipeline route, brought their claims as taxpayers and not as landowners along the route. Their complaint contained a litany of claims challenging the constitutionality of the law on separation of powers, due process, and equal protection grounds, and characterized the law as special legislation. Ultimately, Lancaster County District Court Judge Stephanie Stacy struck down the law, the 2012 legislation, and concluding that the governor approval option improperly removed authority from the Nebraska Public Service Commission. Now, the state appealed, and we argued that the three plaintiffs lacked a sufficient injury in fact to have standing as taxpayers to challenge the law. In addition, the state argued that LB 1161 did not wrongfully divest the Public Service Commission of authority. The Nebraska Constitution is clear in saying that the Public Service Commission has exclusive authority over common carriers. That provision also allows the legislature to limit the PSC's authority, and the legislature did so here by defining common carrier pipelines as only those that operate intrastate as opposed to interstate. Since LB 1161 applies to interstate pipelines, 1161 doesn't divest the Public Service Commission of its constitutional authority. The state also argued that the Public Service Commission's authority was simply over the rate, service, and general control of common carriers. And route approval of a pipeline based on environmental review was never a part of the Public Service Commission's function and therefore could not be an unconstitutional divestment. Finally, route approval under LB 1161 wasn't a complete divestment of the PSC's authority. It was simply an alternative means for route approval for a very limited class of pipelines. Those arguments were submitted in September, and Friday in January, we got a decision from the Nebraska Supreme Court. And in the end, four of the seven justices concluded that the plaintiffs had standing and would have ruled LB 1161 unconstitutional. Those justices said that under common law, the pipeline carriers would be common carriers, and therefore the Public Service Commission should have exclusive jurisdiction over those pipelines. But three justices, the Chief Justice and two others, said standing did not go so far as to allow these taxpayers to challenge the law. The justices also declared that judicial restraint precluded further analysis as to the constitutionality of 1161. So there were four justices that concluded it that they had standing and that it was unconstitutional, but under the Nebraska Constitution, you must have five justices, a supermajority, to declare a law unconstitutional. And since there were not five justices in this case, the law stands. But the legal wrangling is not over. Plaintiffs' taxpayers have asked the Nebraska Supreme Court to reconsider their decision. And while it's very rare that the Nebraska Supreme Court will reconsider, this does mean that a final mandate has not yet issued in the case. In addition, one of the plaintiffs who filed as a taxpayer has now filed suit as a landowner against TransCanada in the county in which they own land. Again, they're arguing the same arguments they did before, that LB 1161 is unconstitutional, for the same reasons they raised at the Nebraska Supreme Court. In addition, it's my understanding that TransCanada, their deadline for filing their eminent domain proceedings was in mid-January, and that January 22nd, I believe, and all of those actions for eminent domain for any of the land that they did not possess the right-of-way on have been filed. So there's no real clear time frame for when these challenges may be before the Nebraska Supreme Court again, but we can expect that that's likely the case. The original challenge transpired just about as quickly as litigation can move in Nebraska. The original complaint was filed in May of 2012, and to have a decision by the Nebraska Supreme Court by January 2015 was very much the fast track for that litigation. So the legal wrangling continues, and we will continue to defend the constitutionality of the law. That's basically my prepared remarks. I guess at this point, Tyler, I would open it up for questions.
Thank you, Katie. Christian, if you will go ahead and give the instructions for folks to queue up and ask questions, then I will go ahead and ask Katie a couple.
Sure.
Questions.
So in a moment you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. So again, to jump in the queue, it's star and then the pound key.
So, Katie, if the plaintiffs now, or one of the plaintiffs now, intend to sue as landowners and not as taxpayers, how is it that they won't be barred by collateral estoppel or issue preclusion?
That's one of the arguments that we anticipate will be argued in this subsequent action. The big catch, I believe, and if you look at the Nebraska Supreme Court's opinion, you can read it 15 different times and probably come to 14 different conclusions. The question is whether or not there has been a final decision on the merits as to the constitutionality of 1161 by the Nebraska Supreme Court. You know, they had a majority, but they didn't have a supermajority, so the law stands. But the reason they didn't have a supermajority is because the three justices kicked the case on standing issues. So I certainly expect that claim preclusion will be one of the arguments raised in this landowner action.
And is this typical division 4-3, is that typical of the Supreme Court in Nebraska, or do they tend
to... No, actually, it's very unusual. The Nebraska Supreme Court tends to issue 7-0 decisions. Once in a while, you'll see a 6-1 or a 5-2, but this is a very non-partisan, studied judiciary that for this opinion from them was probably one of the most sharply divided. Some of the language that they used in the opinion was probably some of the more terse that I have encountered from the justices of the Nebraska Supreme Court.
Very interesting. And here's one. If, this is a big if the president approved the pipeline, would there be any issues of federal preemption to sort of creep in to the case, and would that make some of this moot?
That is a big if, but I'm hopeful that it will happen at some point. The federal preemption issues are probably something that would be more likely to be brought by, frankly, a pipeline company that has never before been regulated in Nebraska, and would, for the first time with this law, be regulated. Now, TransCanada hasn't filed that suit yet, but it's certainly something to watch should the president approve and there be some legal barrier with 1161. Perhaps the federal preemption issues do come in. You know, this pipeline law is not intended, it's relating to siting, which we would argue falls outside of the preemption issues, where clearly pipeline safety is federally preempted, and the state recognizes that. But that's certainly another twist that could come along should a pipeline company actually bring the lawsuit.
Do any of the pipelines go through a FERC approval process like natural gas pipelines? Or do you know if crude oil is treated or heavy oil is treated differently?
I'm not super familiar on the differences on the regulation at the federal level of the pipelines, but it's my recollection that there are differences in how crude oil versus natural gas pipelines are regulated, but for all intents and purposes, it's a very similar process.
Okay, thank you.
Tyler, we did have one question jump on the line.
Excellent.
Fantastic. We'll go right to it.
Good afternoon, everybody. Very interesting presentation. This is Warren Belmar. I had served as the Deputy General Counsel for Energy Policy in the Bush administration at the Department of Energy. And to answer your question concerning crude pipelines versus the natural gas pipelines, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, only has jurisdiction over the siting of natural gas pipelines. With respect to crude oil pipelines, it's a different circumstance. And one of the main changes or differences, which I believe would be critical here, is whether there is a federal power of eminent domain for siting purposes. That is available at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in connection with the natural gas pipeline applications. It is not, to my recollection, available with respect to crude oil pipelines. And if the FERC cannot issue an order that allows for eminent domain, its jurisdiction then would be limited to common carrier kind of regulation to the extent the pipeline was subject to FERC jurisdiction on rates and items of that nature. Just wanted to put my two cents in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Again, if anyone has any questions, press the star and then the pound key. Katie, I have another one to throw out there for you. In determining standing for taxpayers in Nebraska, are there any unique aspects of case law there that would have had the courts split 4-3, or typically is taxpayer standing something that is rather straightforward in Nebraska?
It's actually a very recent or relatively recent development that they would even contemplate taxpayer standing, and it now is in those. At one point, there really was taxpayer standing was not something recognized, that you really were required to have an injury in fact. There was a rare exception for, you know, important public policy issues, and we argued that, you know, while the pipeline itself may have been an important public policy, this siting law and how this happened would not fall within that. The other part of it that critically here, when it comes to taxpayer standing, is there has to be an expenditure of funds in order for there to be taxpayer standing. However, this particular environmental review that was engaged in by the Department of Environmental Quality was completely and totally paid for by TransCanada. Absolutely no taxpayer funds were utilized to conduct the environmental review. So our argument was, how can a taxpayer have standing to bring this challenge when there wasn't any taxpayer funds expended? Now, that was part of the argument that the justices didn't really get into. I think more their greater concern was, well, you know, maybe somewhere along the line, surely something was not compensated for, and the bigger risk of the policy of this limited exception completely swallowing the rule. And if as taxpayers they had standing to challenge the law, that limited exception would completely swallow the injury in fact requirement.
And for the justices who actually got to the merits of the case, what seemed to really sway them into ruling that this was unconstitutional, even though the legislature seemed to be allowed to narrow the scope of the jurisdiction of the PSC?
We thought it was very clear in the Nebraska Constitution that the legislature had the authority to limit the PSC's authority, and that they had done so here. Those four justices, their analysis was, to be frank, very consistent with what the district court had concluded, that actually when looking at the common carrier law, you needed to look at the common law for what would be defined as a common carrier, and that the legislature didn't have the authority to limit who was a common carrier, but simply the extent of the jurisdiction over the common carrier. So I think that was the primary analysis by which they turned it on and said that the Public Service Commission should have been the one to conduct this analysis.
And the three dissenting justices said that words mean something, and this is me editorializing, I guess, but that the words in the Constitution mean something, and therefore the legislature did have the authority to narrow the jurisdiction of the PSC.
Well, actually, those three justices said judicial restraint. They, you know, they emphasized that you need to show judicial restraint, and since there is not standing, they did not weigh in on the merits of whether or not the law was constitutional or not.
Christian, do we have any questions?
We don't. So again, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, our lines are open. So star and then the pound key.
How is the I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to just briefly say, you know, I think the four justices that how they ruled that the ones that ruled there was standing and how they ruled that they believed the law would be unconstitutional, I think is a helpful guidepost for us going forward. Not that we're necessarily going to dissuade or convince those justices to change their mind if this case comes back up to the Nebraska Supreme Court, which I'm pretty sure it will. But it certainly will help us to tailor our arguments to make sure that we don't lose the three that had concluded no standing, that that they will reach the conclusion that the law is constitutional as well.
And when you were arguing before the court, did it seem were there questions trying to further understand your argument, or did it seem as though they were had already sort of come to some sort of conclusion? And I guess what I'm saying was, how do you think the oral argument affected the outcome?
It's hard to say. I will say it was a hot bench. I've argued in front of them a number of times, and I got my first two sentences out and didn't get much further before the questions came, and they peppered us pretty well. And I would, based on the inquiries that were made by the justices, I had a fairly good idea of where I thought a lot of the justices were going, but frankly, there were a couple of them that I thought were leaning more towards siding with my side of the argument, and ultimately concluded that there was standing the law was unconstitutional. So I really think, and frankly, September to January was a fairly long time for this court to render their opinion, and obviously when it's as long as, you know, a 60-page long opinion does take some time to compile. But this, I truly believe there was a lot of discussion and analysis, and I really think they gave this a studied thought in coming to the reaching the opinion that they reached.
Well, again, our lines are open, so if you would like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
Not such a hot bench from the teleforum. This is easy.
I'll throw another one out there to you, Katie. What did you think that was your strongest argument, both on standing and on the merits?
Frankly, standing was, we had, from a policy perspective, we were concerned about standing and the fact that the exception would swallow the rule. But as to this particular case, we were actually quite hopeful that they would just not rule on the standing part, because we knew that that would mean that we are where we are right now, which is no actual final decision from the Nebraska Supreme Court, and we have to go through this all over again with the landowners now bringing the action. But frankly, to us, the strongest argument was that these pipeline carriers are not common carriers that would be subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Public Service Commission. The Nebraska legislature clearly limits common carrier pipelines in Nebraska to those which operate intrastate, not inter, but intrastate. And since these large pipelines were ones that are operating interstate, and in fact internationally, that they would not be common carriers under Nebraska law.
And was that law changed recently, or has that been a long-standing?
I believe 1967 is when the definition came into play for the definition of intrastate common carriers, bringing those which operate intrastate. I mean, some form of the law has been in place since 1967. So this is not a new idea. And frankly, it makes some logical sense going back to the preemption issue that to the extent there would be authority over a common carrier, it would be those that operate intrastate, because primarily interstate common carriers would be those regulated by FERC, especially when you're talking about pipelines.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan. I just want to go ahead and make a quick programming note on behalf of the Federal Society. For those of you listening, our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th at noon Eastern, featuring former Attorney General Ed Meese, and he will be talking on voter ID laws. So again, that is tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th at noon Eastern time. And Tyler, it looks like we did have one more question jump on the line.
Fantastic.
Hi, I have just a question about today's content. Katie, will you be writing, will a summary of today's comments, your commentary about the argument, be posted with the podcast? Thank you.
I am happy to do so if that's something that the Federalist Society would like. I'll touch base with Tyler and the rest of the group once we're done here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Great. And as the caller mentioned, we will be using this as a podcast, so if you are interested in re-listening to this or missed any part of it, you can find this podcast as well as the podcasts of all of our previous telephone conference calls on our website at fedsoc.org. And you can also find our podcast on iTunes as well. So, again, you can find this podcast and stream it at any point. So, again, we still have a little bit of time left. So if we have any other questions on the line, star and then the pound key.
Katie, this is Tyler again. I want to throw this out there, and it may just be more of an intellectual exercise than anything practical. But in contemplating a way to bypass the executive branch and approving the pipeline, there's currently the House and the Senate are in the process of passing legislation that would remove that authority from the president to make the decision. But something that occurred to me would be using interstate compacts between the states where the pipeline would be sited and approved by Congress. I don't know if that would necessarily work because of the international border crossing, but if you or any other callers may have insight into using interstate compacts to potentially bypass the executive branch on this.
Well, certainly I think there is a capacity for the states to work together. And from my perspective, the relationship of the Midwestern states, the Dakotas and Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, we have very good working relationships with those states, with those state governments. It would seem to make some sense, Montana, would make some sense to work towards a compact or a consistent agreement for pipelines seeking to get pipeline approval through those particular states. That being said, ultimately the decision is left with the president as to whether or not this is in the national interest. And while the states may be able to compact with each other and get approval from Congress, I believe it is only the federal government that can negotiate that sort of a treaty or that sort of approval, and particularly the border crossing with Canada.
Tyler, we did have one more question just jump on.
Excellent.
Yes, could you say a few words about the nature of the plaintiffs in this case, and whether or not they just happen to be particularly individually zealous about this issue, or whether they're acting as pawns in more of a concerted effort and where the financing is helping to support the litigation on the plaintiff's side. And then the other sort of related question about this protracted litigation potentially going back up to the Supreme Court again, were there any comments, at least at a public policy level, about how an important national infrastructure project can be stalled for a period of many years, and whether or not the judicial system is responding to this in an adequate way?
Good questions. First, as to these plaintiffs, Nebraska is a very, I would say, a very red state and very conservative leaning, but there is certainly a grassroots populist independent streak amongst Nebraskans as well, which we have seen in previous iterations with the low-level nuclear waste dump that was to be sited in Nebraska, and in fact, some of the plaintiffs are located very close to where that waste dump would have been located, and they are very good at developing a groundswell of support or of opposition to a particular issue that they're concerned about. And in this case, it was very important to them and frankly to all Nebraskans to make sure that the groundwater was adequately protected. TransCanada was responsive in moving the pipeline, adjusting the pipeline route to make sure that the most fragile parts of the aquifer were the pipeline was moved out of that particular location. We understand that they had sufficient safety and protective measures in place, that if ever there was a spill, that it would not contaminate the aquifer, and that there would be sufficient remediation to address any spill that would happen. That being said, that concern was what brought about this law in the first place. And these plaintiffs, I will tell you, I had conversations with them in 2000, probably 2010. For sure, early 2011, long before this litigation had ever been passed, these particular landowners were very concerned about the issue and have, while they probably have led the rallying cry, they are. I would certainly not call them pawns. They are most definitely very engaged in the issue and concerned about it. As to the litigation holding up, whether the judiciary is holding up the construction of this national infrastructure, I have a hard time accepting that this siting decision was truly the basis for why the pipeline was not built, or that the president did not provide the authority and the approval that was necessary. Nebraska conducted the environmental review that was required. We did so in a very efficient, expedient manner, concluded there was no risk to the groundwater or unacceptable risk to the environment associated with the construction of this pipeline, and it was approved 2 years ago, January of 2013. There really is no basis for that to then cause a delay in the approval by the president. And frankly, should this law have been struck down as unconstitutional, we go back to, the law could have simply been struck completely, and there would have been no restriction again on a pipeline company's eminent domain authority. Now, there's an argument that they would have had to go through the Public Service Commission. That's possible that the TransCanada could have had to do that, but it would have been just as easy for the justices to strike the law in its entirety and force the And then we are back to where we were pre-2011, when there was no restriction on eminent domain for pipeline companies in Nebraska.
So, Katie, the origin of the legislation was meant to be a protection for landowners?
Probably to ensure there was a sufficient environmental review to protect not necessarily the landowners, but the groundwater beneath the land upon which they live, to make sure that the pipeline did not go through the most sensitive parts of the Ogallala Aquifer, and that sufficient measures were in place to protect it if something did happen.
Well, Tyler, our lines are open. So, again, if you'd like to jump on, press star and then the pound key.
Katie, you feel free to pass on this question because I know many folks often do. But would you predict if this came back up, the plaintiffs suing now as landowners and not taxpayers, if it were to get passed with standing not an issue, would you see or anticipate the same ruling?
I think there's definitely an argument that as landowners now they would have, they certainly have a stronger argument as to standing. So that certainly may sway the justices that are on to reach the merits of the issue. As to whether or not it is unconstitutional, now that we understand the justices' concern, hopefully the arguments can be made in a way that persuade them that no, this is not something that is. This kind of review is not something that should be exclusively vested in the Public Service Commission. That being said, it was a 4-3 vote. All they would need is to get one of those justices on the three side to switch over to the other side, and then we would have a law being declared unconstitutional, which it's hard to say exactly where the justices would fall on that. I would like to think that we could keep the three that sided with us on standing and concluding that the law is not unconstitutional, but stay tuned.
If anyone else has a question, pound and then the star key.
It looks like we did have one more just jump on.
Fantastic.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hello. I was wondering, I came in the call about 5 minutes into your discussion, so I missed the very beginning. If you could just sort of sum up in 30 seconds, what is the court trying to decide? I guess there's a standing issue and then the merits. So if you could start what the merits are, what the central question is, and then what was the issue of standing? And just be brief. I don't want you to repeat yourself.
Sure. Absolutely. The question was basically the two arguments that we raised was that the plaintiffs did not have standing, and secondly, that this pipeline law did not divest the Nebraska Public Service Commission of its constitutionally vested authority over common carriers. And our reason for saying it was not common carriers is because they were not, the Nebraska law defines common carriers, common pipeline carriers, as those that operate intrastate. As to the standing conclusion, four justices said that they had standing as taxpayers to challenge the law. Three concluded that they did not, that taxpayer standing was insufficient to challenge the constitutionality of the law. Because it takes five to rule a law unconstitutional, only four of them said there was standing and jurisdiction to lie. The law was upheld. That being said, those four who said there was standing concluded that the law was unconstitutional. So based on the fact that they went to the common law definition of common carriers and concluded that the Public Service Commission had exclusive jurisdiction over these particular types of pipeline carriers. That was way longer than 30 seconds. Sorry.
Well, Tyler, do you have any more questions?
I would just want to thank Katie for taking the time to debrief us on the intricacies of how this is playing out in the Nebraska courts. It gets a lot of attention on the national media, but when you really get down into the details of how this works, I know my knowledge base has been expanded tremendously, and I just wanted to say thank you to Katie and to the Federalist Society for hosting the call, and Katie, it has to be a huge honor to you. Are the Teleforum expert on the call today, and tomorrow it's Attorney General Meese. So that's a
wow.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Katie Spahn, as Tyler mentioned, but also Tyler Ward for moderating today's call. And as Tyler mentioned, tomorrow we do have former Attorney General Ed Meese at noon Eastern time discussing voter ID laws. So thank you all for your participation. Thank you to our audience for calling in and for asking questions. And once again, a reminder that you can find the podcast of this Teleform call as well as all of our previous Teleform calls on our website at fedsoc.org. So until tomorrow, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.